Sloppy Spoilers with your host, DT2.
Welcome to another episode of Sloppy Spoilers. I'm David Taylor 2, DT2 Comics Chat, your host. Tonight we're going to be talking about Season 2, Episode 7 of The Umbrella Academy and The Boys. I'd like to welcome my co-host, David Nemesis Howard. What's up, Dave?
Hey, what's going on, everybody? And glad to be back and talking to some boys and Umbrella Academy.
Where can we find you on Twitter?
You can find me at NemesisFC2.
Excellent. I'd like to welcome Jeff, Dr. Faye Bracey. What's up, Jeff?
Oh, man, it has been too far too long away from you guys and our friendly listeners out there. So glad to be here.
Where can we find you on Twitter?
Yeah, you can find me at Bracey452. That's Bracey452.
All right, we're going to start off talking about the Umbrella Academy Season 2, Episode 7, entitled Ooga for Ooga or Ooga for Ooga. Okay? Now, the first question I want to ask you guys right off the bat is, what do you think of a ticking clock as a plot device? Do you love it? Do you hate it? Do you use it when you write? Do you try to stay away from it? What are your thoughts? Start with Nemesis.
Have we talked about this before?
We have.
We might have, but okay. I want to put it in the context of this episode.
My answer is exactly the same as I think that I answered before, which is, I'm fine with it as long as the ticking clock, A, makes sense within the plot, and B, actually keeps real time. I hate it when, like, you know, pick any movie where the guy sets the bomb to explode for 5 seconds, and then we get 35 seconds of the person fighting people and getting out of the building. It's the longest 5 seconds ever. That's what I can't stand. You know,
in our case, we talked about it in terms of Stargirl, where it didn't work.
Right, right. So if it's a plot device, it works for the plot. You know, there's a reason to have the clock up there, and it keeps, you know, the time accurate, and it's not like we're stretching out the longest 10 seconds ever, then I'm fine with it. So, you know, but as a general rule, I don't have a problem with it one way or the other. It's how it's executed.
Like in The Dark Knight Rises, where we see the bomb is going off in 5 seconds,
mm-hmm.
and Batman has time to fly it out over the river and somehow get out of the Batplane and survive all that?
Exactly.
Okay. Go ahead, Bracey. What are your thoughts?
In this particular case, I didn't mind the ticking clock. And as a plot device, I'm not against it, as long as it's utilized well. As I mentioned really quickly there, we discussed how it didn't work so well in the context of Stargirl, that it just ended up being rather pointless. In this case, it was also pointless, but I knew it was going to be pointless, so it was okay. Because you knew this hodgepodge mess of these people, there was no way in hell they were going to make it back to the alley in time. Somebody was going to mess it up. Somebody's going to keep Doomsday going. You know, so it was never an issue for me. I was just waiting to see who was going to mess it up and how. And surprisingly, the only person who made it to the alley was Luther, of all people.
Yeah. Plus, we have 3 more episodes, you know, so.
Yeah.
That's what I want to key in on, is if it's always going to be an all-for-nothing situation, then why use it? You know, I've said it before, but it bears repeating here. No longer are we in a time where the quote-unquote good guys can just win. Now they have to win but be broken. Now they have to win but be screwed somehow. Now they have to win by the skin of their teeth. Now they have to win but you created something worse. And these two shows are kind of the epitome of all that. So when I'm looking at the ticking clock, I'm like, why did y'all even put it in there when you know good well this ain't gonna work?
You know, that's such an interesting point you make. You know, you think back to classic shows like the George Reeves Superman. Can you imagine if Superman had to win the way these guys have to win? My Lord, no one would ever watch that show. Superman had been like having to throw a child out the window to get the gangsters or something, you know?
Right. Well, that's what makes episodes like City on the Edge of Forever so powerful. Because Kirk is the classic swashbuckler, the classic space pirate, the classic, you know, he's that guy. And that's also what made Wrath of Khan so powerful.
Yeah.
One of the lines that Kirk says in Star Trek III, I love it, he says, "This time we pay for the party with our dearest blood."
Right.
So you can tell that he has been kind of laughing his way through life. He's kind of, he's been cheating death, he's been avoiding death, and then in sitting on the edge of forever, it slaps him right in the face. You're going to have to give up someone you fall in love with for the greater good, because you can't change the timeline like that. And then Wrath of Khan, his past comes back to haunt him and cost him his best friend. And then in Search for Spock, cost him his kid. So it's like old school John Wayne types were used to being surrounded by bad guys with guns and not getting hit by any bullets.
Right. But even so then,
now we've gone the other way.
That's an interesting That's an interesting discussion for another pod because, you know, Kirk with the whole "I don't believe in the no win scenario," and it's true to a point. But yeah, I see what you're saying as well. So
I would throw this in before I move on to my next point. I was having this discussion with my son the other day, and I was trying to explain to him the impact of the Empire Strikes Back. One of the things I told him, I was like, "You'd have to be alive at that time, son. I can't make you understand. We were still coming off an era where it was like I just explained, where the heroes, not only did they not lose, they never got hurt. So all of the heroes back in that day could be surrounded by bad guys. They wouldn't even get hurt. They could be punched and avoid the blows, or they wouldn't feel them, or they would miss the bullets, or they just laugh. So when we saw Vader cut Luke's hand off, it was stunning, because it was so rare that a protagonist actually got physically maimed in a confrontation.
Yeah.
It wasn't unheard of, but it was rare.
And then to end on that cliffhanger with Han captured.
I forget what show it was. I think it was like Last Action Hero or something, with the infamous flesh wound. Every time a hero got shot, it was a flesh wound, you know?
Yeah.
So. Right. So, yeah, so again, contextually, it's just interesting to see how, quote unquote, wins come about now, if you can even call them that. Okay, now, on to the next point, because that last point was about the handler just kind of messing with Five once again, which, once again, I don't even know why Five even deals with her. Why would he even deal with her? It's a deal with the devil. You're going to get screwed. But anyway, so next thing I want to talk about is, most of us agree that Five is not our favorite character, which for most of us he is. He's also the most interesting character. But here's my next question. Do you feel differently about him when you get reminded of his assassin past? He's been caring much more about his family. He's been a little bit more sensitive, at least for Five. He's been more in tune to what's going on. But we're reminded in this episode that this dude is a killer, and he's basically amoral. He's a killer with very little conscience. So I want to know, when you're reminded of that past, even though we're dealing with, quote unquote, a kinder, gentler Five, if you will, when you're reminded of who he is and what he's done, does that change the way you feel about the character? Start with Grayson.
If you're thinking in the context of the scene where he goes ahead and he annihilates the commission, it didn't bother me. And it didn't bother me because these are people who place assassins all over the world and apparently all over the time stream doing horrible things to people who, you know, we have no context whether they deserved it or not. You know, the handler herself, she stole a child away from a family who got murdered in front of that child to raise her as yet another assassin cog in this machine.
Yes.
So you want to see the handler die, sure, but like I had no problem seeing the commission get wiped out by Five, because I'm pretty sure they deserved it. And, you know, that's something that allows us to identify with somebody like the Punisher, per se. He does really terrible things. He goes out of his way not to hurt innocents, but at the same time, you have to recognize the fact that, you know, he's a mass murderer. He's all about vengeance as opposed to justice. You know, this is what separates him from Batman. So, Five, in the context of the show, I can still identify enough with. It's kind of like how you can kind of get on board with John Wick, because, you know, this is a dude who's been part of this elite organization of assassins. He has likely in his lifetime killed people who were innocent. You know, somebody powerful wanted somebody dead, and that's the end of that. But because we got framed up in his life after, and the love of his wife and everything that meant to him, we have kind of forgiven him to an extent. And I feel the same thing about Five, because he does have this deep, loving connection to his family. And so we're able to look past the atrocity and identify with the character, even though he's not a good person.
That's a really good answer. What do you think, Nemesis?
Yeah, I definitely agree with Jeff. I think it depends on how far down the rabbit hole I go with him, and it's the same thing with John Wick. Based on what we've been shown with both of those characters, I don't have a problem with them, with what they've done. You know, John Wick has a code. I empathize with them, and then, you know, I enjoy seeing him kick ass. Same thing with Five. However, there are moments, you know, I'm specifically thinking back to season one, the fight in the donut shop, you know, and the joy he got out of toying with those people and killing them. And then the same thing with here with the commission, even though the commission deserved it, the joy he seems to get out of his work. And then if you start to go down the rabbit hole, and if they showed us, you know, other things he's done, I definitely think my view of the character would change. I look at Five in much the same way that I look at, like, a Deadpool. Deadpool is a character that I enjoy reading. I think he's funny and everything, but he's also an assassin. If they ever showed us a Deadpool actually back in before he became Deadpool, when he was Wade Wilson doing horrible things, I think that would definitely change the way you look at not only Wade Wilson, but Deadpool going forward, because you would have gone too far down the rabbit hole. And, you know, I'm going to throw out all the cliches here. You would have seen how the sausage was made, and then you'd probably fall out of love with the character. So,
now, both brought up John Wick. My thing with John Wick is, because I agree with everything you said about it, my thing with John Wick is that it was always clear to me two things. Number one, he understood he had to live with what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And so they show him having a different level of conscience than almost everybody else in the film. Number one. Number two, he understood on some level that him not really being able to have a happy ending was somewhat karmic. So once again, that ties me back to point number one. He understood that you can't just shed all that blood and the universe is not going to answer you some kind of way. And that's what I think makes him sympathetic as a character. Is him just having to come to grips with, you know, this was the path I chose. And this is going to have ramifications. Because just about everybody else in that movie was like, you know, another day, another hit. Give me a drink. And that was it, you know. So I think showing some type of remorse or showing some type of the character understanding that there's going to be some kind of answer in life makes him way more sympathetic. Way more sympathetic. Okay, I'm not really interested in talking about Diego or Lila because I hate both of them. So we're just going to skip over that unless you have something burning you want to talk about, because I hate both of them.
Nope.
So with the point you want to make there, but I can't stand either one. They're both, he's a nothing burger, and she has been trouble from the moment. Remember I told you, just like I didn't like Girardi? The minute I saw her, I couldn't stand her.
You just knew.
Right, so I'm not really, you know, they just don't interest me because it's not going to end well, but it's just showing how weak Diego is as a person.
I think there's definitely better, more interesting things to talk about other than those two, so.
They keep defining him by his daddy issues, but that's one note. That's like all he is now. Pass. Anyway, so I want to talk about Allison. Now, this was the scene I was waiting for. This is what I hoped we would get to see. What happens when, one, Allison reveals her powers, but two, she says, don't stay here, come with me. Let's take this life we've built, and even though the fight still continues in 2019, it's at a different stage, and Ray's got to make a choice. And he does make a choice, and he says that he's going to stay where he is because his time and the movement at the level that he's in it still needs him. And then she says, well, I can take the, you know, the memory of our experience away. And he said he'd rather live with the pain and with the knowledge. He'd rather keep the memory of loving her and their time together than have it erased. And that whole thing I thought was so powerful. It was so powerful because, again, that whole storyline is the most human and the most relatable, at least for me, and the most, if such a thing could happen, it doesn't feel comic booky. It feels very much like real people having to make choices. And so I just thought that was really powerful. I thought it was really moving. Of course, just like always, I put myself in both positions. If I'm Allison and I've got powers and I've got to tell this woman that I've married that, you know, there's something very important about myself I've got to tell you. Not only do I have powers, but I'm not even from this town. Do you love me enough to make the time jump? If I'm Ray, and my wife tells me I'm not what you think I am, and I've got powers and I'm from a different time, do you love me enough to come with me? So I thought it was so powerful. So I want to hear you guys' thoughts on the scene, but I also want you to put yourself very briefly in the shoes of both characters and tell me what you do. Start with Nemesis.
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm going to say that the thing that I've been kicking around in my head for a while now, and I'm just going to out and out say it, is that, you know, we all love Five as a character. He's enjoyable on screen, but far and away the best part of this season, and this is, I don't know what this says about the writers and the show and everything, but the best character and the best moments of this whole season have been when Ray is on screen. Ray is the most interesting character. Ray has the most compelling storylines. Ray has the most depth to him. I mean, Ray is great. And unfortunately, Ray is not going to be around after the season. So, you know, as far as I know, you know, unless something changes. Putting myself in those characters' shoes, I could definitely understand Ray's point of view and what he tells Allison as far as he's got work to do here. It was a very moving scene. It makes sense. It's that noble sacrifice. It's, you see it all through different parts of literature and things as well. The knight on the mission or the samurai or whatever, sacrificing personal satisfaction for a greater good. So Ray is taking that tack, and I appreciate that, and it makes sense, and it rings true. Even though it is harmful, I would like to think that I would be Ray. I have been in those types of situations before. Obviously, nothing as hard or as difficult as that. But, you know, those are the kind of choices that I would hope that I would be able to make. From Allison's standpoint, putting myself in her standpoint, once again, Allison is tempted. You know, the temptation for her to use her powers and just force it on Ray, and he would never know, is always going to be there. But at the same time, once again, kudos to Allison, kudos to the writers. Allison has that wisdom to understand that even if she were to do that, she is opening Pandora's box. She's introducing poison into that relationship, and Lord knows when that would finally come to fruition, when that, you know, whatever she has poisoned their relationship with would finally take seed and arise. You know, maybe Ray gets his memories back. Maybe Ray finds out, you know, finds a picture of himself in the 60s. Who knows what happens, but nothing good could possibly come of her doing something like that. But she's tempted, just like I think any of us would be tempted, because she loves Ray and she would like her husband to come with her and take that away, take that choice away from him, because she doesn't want that hurt. But she's wise enough not to force it. And so, kudos to the writers for writing something real, something that has real human emotions, even if you took out the supernatural aspect, because there are situations we could put real people in where those types of things happen. And it's very well done.
Very well done. And yes, it is very much true to life. When you see people having career changes, Sometimes you have to uproot the family. Sometimes you have to decide, am I willing to leave everything I've known for the unknown? Because mm-hmm. that's the real question here. And people deal with that in real life all the time. Go ahead, Bracey.
Damn, Ray's just the best character. What a man. I mean, seriously, he's won me over the way Pat Dugan won us over watching Star Wars Girl. He is just the character. He is absolutely the best character in so many ways. When you've got so many broken people, here's a man dealing with a time of great tribulation with class and a strict moral compass and just so much grace. Really, a really graceful person. He's nothing but admiration for the character. And he does the right thing. Ray always does the right thing in the voice, in the face of adversity and violence and lies and deceit and traps, and even in the face of the unknown and the unknowable, Ray always ends up doing the right thing. Now, this is not to say he isn't human. He obviously had his flare-ups with Allison when he was discovering what was going on or trying to figure out what was going on with her. But he always swings back around. You know, he's as true blue as somebody like Captain America or Superman. He is the man. And like Nemesis, I'm going to be sad when the season's over and he's presumably no longer a part of the show, because he just shines. Steals the show whenever he's in there. Now, making the choice, putting myself in both positions here. I would like to think I could do what Ray did. And it would be a different perspective if I had at stake what Ray had at stake. I have not been in that position. I am not a man who is fighting for the betterment of my people. You know, if you put me in that position right now, the only thing that would keep me from taking the leap is thinking about the pain it would cause those in my life who are still here. If I jump forward 50, 60 years into the future, my family's never going to know what happened to me. I will have just disappeared. There's no body. There's no nothing. They have no closure. I don't think I could do that to my family, not to my mother, my brothers, my dad, and all that, but you know, considering how much I love my wife, there would still be a tremendous temptation. And sometimes I make an impulsive decision, so I can't say 100% for sure. If either way, I'm living with regret. Either way. On Allison's side of things, once again, she shows herself to be the best of the Umbrella Academy. And for me, her decision's a much easier decision to make. She's a little bit more tempted than I would be, because she actually asked Ray, would you like to come with me? And would you like me to take it away? And I would do neither of those things. What Ray's doing is very important. Even though I know the future, I don't know what part he plays in the past. So it's important that he does what he does. But if he were to ask me to come along, then I can see myself like, all right, pack your things, let's go. But I'm not going to be the one to make that decision for him. I'm not going to be the tempter. I might end up being the enabler, but I'm not going to be the tempter. And also, I would never even suggest taking his memory away, because I know on the other side, like Ray, I would want to treasure that, even with the pain it's going to cause, because we are made up of our experiences. And if you take away that memory, you're taking away something very essential to who I am now. And as Nemesis said, there's also the repercussion. If you wipe out his memories, then people go like, man, whatever happened to your wife? He's like, what wife? You know, you've been married for a year. So that creates a whole new kettle of fish that the writers didn't really get into, because, you know, the short form fiction. But there you go. This, it really pleased me, though. Both these characters did the right thing, even though it hurt. And that is being a hero.
Yeah, I would have to say,
well written, and but a real conundrum, and that's what I like to see when you have real moral choices with consequences.
Yeah,
then you have to live with them. That's what helps us connect as an audience. Just to use writer's code for a minute,
I'd have to say, I'd have to say for me personally, the only thing that ever comes even close to Ray's decision that happened in my life was when I volunteered to go back in the Army after 9/11. And that is the only thing that ever came close to that kind of, decision making. And that was probably one of the hardest, most emotional things that I had ever gone through in my marriage. And I had an infant son and everything. So I could definitely empathize with Ray.
Absolutely. Okay. And so also we get yet another glimpse of why Allison understands why her power in particular is just so dangerous, because she gets one of the Swedish brothers who once again, all season long, have been big nothing burgers. I'm like, are y'all supposed to be intimidating? Are you supposed to be scary? Are you supposed to be Terminators? Are you the Ghost Twins or the Matrix Reloaded? What are you? Because you are just nothing. Just not interesting. It's just when you're on the screen, it's just time is dragging. I don't know what you're doing, and I don't care. But Allison demonstrates, just like Jean Grey, what happens when you have that kind of power, what that can be turned into very, very quickly if you don't constantly keep it in check.
Mm-hmm.
When she has that brother kill himself, and it's just a testament again to who she is as a person to say, you know, I can't just willy-nilly unleash this on the world. Which takes us to Vanya, who's the opposite of Allison. So I hear groans from my co-host. And so,
oh, boy.
Vanya is in the exact same situation, except Vanya always seems to default to being very selfish, but not just being selfish, being rather small-minded. I don't know if you could attribute that to her abuse or her daddy issues, whatever you want to call it, but Vanya will always bring everything back to being about her, mess up the world, and then say, I'm sorry, it's like that fixes anything. So Vanya's in the exact same situation. She wants his assistant in Harlem to go back with her to 2019, and Bob is like, no, that can't happen. So Vanya says, well, then forget it, I'm not going. Or then she says, but I'm going to do it anyway. And then Sissy has to write Carl a Dear John letter. And John was like, no, stupid, don't do it. But of course she did it. And then so they get stopped by the cop, said blah, 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 blah. And Vanya fights again. And the police eventually knock her out. But once again, she's causing ridiculous amounts of destruction. For me, for selfish reasons, like, you know, she's got to have it her way, or she's literally going to tear the planet up. That's like her theme. So I want to hear you guys' thoughts about Vanya being in the exact same situation, but the choices that she made start with Nemesis.
This whole thing with Sissy, Harlan, and Vanya is just a litany of stupidity from beginning to end. It really is.
Yes.
First of all, both of these grown-ass women are dealing with a special needs child from the 60s. And they don't give one thought to what moving him through time is going to do to this child at all.
Yes.
And Sissy, you know, the mother doesn't think about it. Vanya doesn't think about it. It seems that the only two thing that Vanya's thinking about is hooking up with Sissy. Sissy's kind of thinking about Harlan, but not really. And then they go out, and, you know, they're going back and forth. And I thought Sissy was going to make a good choice, and then Vanya convinces her to leave. Then, okay, they compound the stupidity with leaving that note. All right, you're leaving this guy. Who in their right mind is going to leave a note to this controlling husband? Why would you do that? Who writes this? And the real problem I have here is that I think the writers thought that they were writing a compelling scene about characters making difficult life choices and being brave and everything. And I'm just watching this going, they're being stupid here, being stupid there, selfish, idiotic, you know, and at some point I just gave up caring, which brings us then to the final, you know, act in this, you know, stupidity play where Vanya decides to get out and fight these police officers, and she's lucky she didn't get her head blown off, quite honestly. And like you said, I think it's all for selfishness. Is that Vanya, how do I put this? Vanya is that middle child who feels like the world owes her something because everything has been against her whole life. And so she refuses to see anything outside of herself and believes that every situation is some oppressive force against her, and that if she doesn't get what she wants, it's just not fair, and so she's going to foot stomp. And what makes it even worse is that when Vanya stomps her foot, the world ends.
Right. She's got Phoenix-level power, Dark Phoenix-level power.
Mm-hmm.
Enough to wipe out planets and planetoids and whatever. And yeah, it's just, oh. Go ahead, Bracey.
Yeah, this episode alone, I have not liked Vanya the entire season, and this episode made me just hate her. There's... excuse me. I'm talking about the last situation with Allison and Ray. You know, I mentioned how sacrifice is heroism in the proper context. Vanya's got none of that. Like, she, Nemesis brilliantly described her as that middle child, and that is so, so fitting, where everything has to be me, 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 my, you know, I'm the most important thing. It's almost weirdly a reflection of the culture that's going on right now, where it's just so self-absorbed that nothing else matters, no consequences. And it's like you said, like, poor Sissy doesn't even know where they're going, you know. It's bad enough, like, the when Vanya shows off her powers, the expected happen, and that's why it snaps her back. Like, Sissy's horrified that she's got these terribly destructive powers. It's like, what did you think was going to happen when she found out about that? Like, you look and you know, it's like, oh yeah, I didn't mess up big. What's going to happen when you take this child to 2019 with all the sensory overload of our modern world on a kid, you know, who's been living out in the middle of nowhere? Oh, jeez. No, but that's Vanya. She doesn't think. She doesn't think anyway. She is a reactive force. That's all she is. She reacts. She reacts, she reacts, she reacts. And every time she reacts poorly. And I have a big problem with the rest of the family because she literally destroyed the world in the first season. And they were just kind of like, eh, you know, Diego's the only one to really say anything. At least Luther attempted to take some action, but he had some feels about it. But my opinion is they should all be trying to kill her as quickly as possible. Really, she's got to go. She is death incarnate, and she is going to end the world if you don't stop her.
Well, she's a Phoenix character that doesn't realize that she needs to die. We got to give Jean Grey her props, because Jean did eventually realize, I can't go on like this, because when I lose my temper, you know, planets suffer, and I can't stay in control every day for the rest of my mortal life, so I need to end myself. That was the original ending of the Dark Phoenix saga, and it was so powerful, but Jean had sense enough to realize this has got to stop here.
Vanya
has no such self-awareness.
I will say this, the longer this season goes on, and the more that I see of Vanya, and just how unable she is to deal with real life and make some adult decisions, the more that I empathize totally with Hargreaves and what he did to her, as far as, you know, controlling her and everything. I'll be honest with you. I mean, that's kind of a horrible thing to say.
If you understood her potential, as you have to figure he did, it makes a lot of sense now.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, I really liked her up until this point. Once I saw how she's trying to basically steal another family,
mm-hmm.
and she doesn't care even what that's going to do to them,
mm-hmm.
but
it tells me that she's in love with an idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the reason I said that, though, is the longer we have seen her off of the medication that Hargreaves had her on, the more I dislike her, which says something for Hargreaves, I think.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. You can understand a little bit.
Like, first season, you could you can sympathize with her, but I don't have any of that this season.
But see, that goes to a larger point, and then we're going to talk about the last thing we'll be done with this. The larger point is, this is hard for 21st century Americans to understand. And if you want to see it played out every day, you can see it played out on Twitter and social media in general. Because somebody came up with the brilliant idea of saying that every person should have a voice. And every voice should have a platform. They forgot to mention that every voice is not a voice of value. So some people use their voice and their platform to bring narcissistic-based destruction. All they're going to do is spew their venom out on people. They're not bringing the value to the table. But they will say, I have just as much a right to do that, to ruin things for everyone else. And that's a whole other pod, because we want to start getting into what has happened to some of our main franchises.
Yeah.
You know, the Twitter thing made me think of something else about Vanya, and something we touched on before, because she has that 21st century perspective. She probably thinks she's superior to everybody in this time frame right now, not just because of her mutant powers, but because of the fact she comes from this so-called enlightened time, and they're just a bunch of, you know, they're practically backwards Neanderthals to her with their culture and their society as it is now. So she really sees no problem with trying to do what she's doing. If, as far as she's concerned, she is on the right side of history as far as this matter goes.
Yeah,
that's right.
I think she thinks she's a better person than most of her brothers and sisters as well. And probably. I will give her this. Even though I agree with what Hargreaves did to a certain extent, he compounded the problem that I think was already there in her personality by isolating her from her brothers and sisters and creating, you know, that middle child syndrome even worse, because he made her different and apart from them. And yeah. So, you know, I think that caused some of the psychological problems that we see in the character. So
she definitely needed more socialization.
Yeah.
Now, the last thing I want to hit on before we conclude with this one is, and this is another one of those landmine subjects.
Uh-oh.
I want to touch on the idea of Ben taking over Claus's body to have sex with some other girl, and also vice versa. When Jill's trying to have sex with, she assumes that it's Claus, but it's actually Ben. That's such a whole quagmire. Such a whole quagmire in the age of everything having to be consensual, and things should be consensual, don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You should be able to choose or not whom you are intimate with, and no one should be able to force that on you. But in the context of the show, I was just like, okay, what are you trying to say here? Is it okay for Ben to desire someone and jump in Claus's body to get with him and use Claus's popularity, the fact that he's the head of the cult, or however you want to say it, but it's really you having sex with him? That whole thing to me, that just kind of jumped out at me. I was like, wow, you know, like, so what is the point here? Because if all that stuff starts to go down, people could legitimately say to you, I never would have had sex with you if I had known it was actually this person I was sleeping with. Because
mm-hmm.
I thought I was sleeping with this person because you were wearing their skin. So it was just a really, and I was like, okay. You know, there's people on my timeline that are always trying to start Twitter fights over the fact that I prefer Batman with Talia and not Selina. And I stand by it because I do. And they're always pointing out all of Talia's faults. I'm like, Selena doesn't have any, but whatever. you're not going to change my mind. It's just my opinion, but you're not going to change it. But for the longest time, they wrote the way Damien was conceived as a rape, that Talia drugged Bruce. Then they retconned it. I'm like, whatever. So once again, just another example of...
I read The Son of the Demon. That was no rape.
Right, exactly. But, you know, but that wasn't quite this thing. But, you know, if somebody's occupying your space and they're getting busy with people, they think they're getting busy with the shell that you're in, not you. So just briefly give me your thoughts on that whole thing, like in the context of this episode. Like, you know, I don't know, it just struck me as like I don't know, you know, because if you're trying to say that kind of thing is okay, I don't know, man. That's non-consensual. They don't know it's you. So what do you think about that? Cyber bracing.
That was definitely not okay. And it's surprising that they put that in there in the age of Me Too. Especially with somebody on the show like Ellen Page. Who's an activist herself. Surprised that kind of slipped by her.
Elliot Page.
Oh, yeah, whatever. Another landmine to step on, right?
Yep.
I'm going to tromp through this field. I don't care.
Boom.
That's so not right. And Ben, I understand his plight. He is removed from everybody except Klaus. I really understand his need for connection and all that. But he should have just come out and said, like, hey, you know what? I'm not actually Klaus. I'm his dead brother, Ben. I'm channeling for him. This is one of his another powers as a prophet. You know, you could totally go there. But you need to own up to it, because that is false pretenses of the highest order. That's not fair to that girl. Not yes. fair at all. Yes. And Ben should know that. He's just, I guess he's just really desperately lonely. And the fact that he's kind of a love from afar. But, you know, that still doesn't give you the right, because she doesn't know you. And she can't know you in, like, you know, a minute or two when she's got starry eyes for her Messiah. So, yeah, he's totally wrong. And it's a weird move for them to make in this show. Really, really weird. I guess they thought they were just kind of playing it for laughs. But it was a little icky.
If you want to play that concept for laughs, that's like a Freaky Friday concept. Mm-hmm. And especially if you go back to the original one, if you want to play for laughs, you have to keep it light.
Yeah.
But when you're getting into being intimate with someone and hooking up with someone, and again, they don't really know it's you, it's just a whole different thing. Go ahead, Nemesis.
Yeah, I want to thank you for dragging me down into the ick here. I had not given this scene a second thought, to be honest with you. I was just kind of like, yeah, okay, whatever. They're ruining Klaus some more. And now that you've pointed it out and I've thought about it, I was like, yeah, this is really creepy. And Ben is kind of a stalker, because I'm sure Ben has creeped around in ghost form and looked at this girl and seen her, you know, whatever he's doing, and then decides to take over Klaus's body and do this. So I'm like, yeah, Ben's kind of a creep here. So thank you for pointing that out to me. And this is not the first time this situation like this has arisen, because we've seen it in, the first or the second X-Men movies, when Mystique took on other forms, or was it X-3, I think.
And
she tried to sleep with Wolverine and Jean Grey's form, I think. And the natural reaction is always revulsion, you know, because it feels like a violation, which it should. So yeah, it's definitely
a violation.
Yeah, it's definitely a creepy move.
It's like, did we have to prove that Ben is just as damaged as everybody else? Because he kind of forgot that up until that point.
Yeah.
Well, they only write damage.
Yeah.
So everybody's damage is different. Remember, I don't know if you saw the Clash of the Titans remake.
Yeah.
But remember, this was what Zeus did all the time. So Zeus disguised himself as the king.
Yeah.
And that's how we ended up following Perseus. Oh, well. And that's why one of the reasons Perseus hated his divine part of his heritage, because Zeus did that all the time.
That's not even the most.
A movie I saw was Excalibur, when Pendragon requested Merlin. Use the charm of making. He gives him the form of of Uther. I think it was Uther. Anyway, he goes and has sex with this guy who's fighting in a bloody battle on the battlefield. He goes and has sex with his wife because he desired her.
Yeah.
And even as a kid, I was like, that is wrong.
Yeah. Well, then you had Zeus coming down like as a shower of gold and as a bull. Yeah. I'm like, what the hell is going on in Greece, man? It's.
So, yeah, it's just a really interesting premise. Interesting, I mean, that it's so creepy beyond belief. But I always try to put myself, in the shoes of the other person. If there was someone that you thought you wanted to hook up with, and all of a sudden one day they're just so happy to be with you and they haven't been thinking about you, and all of a sudden that switches. And then you find out later someone else had taken over the body and you're really having sex with somebody else, and someone that you would have never got with under normal circumstances. That is a complete violation. That's a complete...
Well, they even did that in, was it Revenge of the Nerds?
Oh, yeah.
With the one nerd. So
Stan in the Vader mask.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so this just seems to be, you know, another really application of that running theme about people disguising themselves as a means to hook up with people that they couldn't get as themselves. And I'm like, oh, okay. All right, well, we got to deal with this again. I'm like, okay, but... But they did it on Smallville when Bizarro was pretending to be Clark. And he and Lana were together for a long time. She didn't even know it wasn't Clark. Mm. And I mean, it's just, you know, over and over and over again. I'm like, okay.
Well, now you're worrying me about what's going on in our society. We keep finding these instances. What the hell's going on out there?
Face off with John Travolta and Nick Cage.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that one too.
It keeps popping up, man. Now that you think about it, it's like, woo, this is a deep rabbit trail.
Oh, man. I'm going to give my wife a blood test when she comes home.
It's like the thing, heat up the needle.
Yeah.
Hey, well, you know, so I'm just like, you know, it's just, the reference you mentioned in X3 Last Stand, Mystique actually morphed into all the X-Men.
Including the teenager.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
She was Storm, she was Rogue, right. So, yeah, so, but my point of bringing it up here was, I was like, I was just really hoping that it doesn't become a theme, that Ben doesn't go through with it, that this doesn't become his thing. Because I'm like, you know, that ruins him as a character. He's impossible to root for. Because it, on some level, it's rape. It's not consensual. I didn't know I was doing it with you. I thought I was doing it with someone else. That means they did not actually give consent.
But it's the same thing with Vanya here. It's just like what she did in the first season's unforgivable. But they had to pull a Jean Grey. They had, it's like, well, you know, she's lost her memory, so it's like she's a different person. They had to give her an out so you can try and like her again this season. But she's proven that she's still that same person.
Yeah, well, men never get an out. Yeah. You never get out when you're male. So it doesn't matter why you do what you do. If you do something like that and you're a man, that's just the end of you. There's no out when you're a man. There's no sympathy. There's no, he was going into him. No, 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 you're just a creep. There's none of that. There's no understanding. There's no mercy when you're a man.
No. And no matter what happens, they've already screwed up the timeline because we know Klaus's timeline has changed now.
Right, right, right. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. And so, anyway, that's it for this episode. We're going to take a break here, let you listen to a few things from our sponsors. And when we come back, we're going to do Umbrella Academy. We're going to do The Boys, Season 2, Episode 7, the penultimate episode. So, everybody take 5.
From the aisles to the review station, Undercover Capes brings you all things action figure related. Join host Bob O'Mac as he shares his insights and thoughts on the plastic revolution.
All right, welcome back. We're going to talk about Season 2, Episode 7 of The Boys, which is Butcher, Baker, Candlestick Maker. Right off the bat, I have to tell you, this episode made me furious. This episode made me so angry, I was willing to quit the series. That's how mad this episode made me. I was so angry at this episode, and I will tell you why. First and foremost, because I did not sign up to watch adult content. That's not, you know, I know whatever this show is supposed to be about. But that was just blatant over the top and not necessary. And I didn't, you know, even understand why. No, I don't want to watch that. I didn't sign up for that. I want to watch a superhero show. So now you're trying to sneak in all this other stuff. It made me so angry I don't want to watch it anymore. And if we weren't reviewing it, I would have been like, okay, well, you just lost a viewer because I didn't sign up for all that. That's number one. Number two, the other reason it made me really angry is because of what we were talking about before, which is they can't just ever have a win. They have to have some type of, there's going to be a heavy price tag. The price tag is going to be so heavy by the time they get to the finish line until it might feel like maybe a tragic win, or it may feel like a win at a cost or whatever. And as a writer, the problem with that, at least from my point of view, is that once everything becomes like that, then just like anything else, it loses its emotional punch. The reason, I'll talk about what I talked about before, the reason that Empire was so powerful was because Luke got physically maimed, which was unheard of back when it happened. The reason Wrath of Khan is so powerful is because of exactly what Kirk said. They had been through so much together, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and the whole original series crew. And they made it through all that they made it through. And then here comes this villain from the past. And for the first time, maybe in his life, Kirk has to pay. And pay dearly. And it's a shock to him that he's 50 in the movie. So that's, you know, 30 plus years in Starfleet where he's never really had to deal with it on that level. And that was the punch. That was the power of the whole story. When you make it something that doesn't normally happen. But once you begin to normalize this type of nihilistic, cynical, kind of dark, kind of you can't just win kind of thing, then everybody becomes superhero Charlie Brown. So no matter how many times you try to kick that football, you have no, it's not going to happen. And that's why I stopped watching The Walking Dead once I realized that's what it was. That all you're watching every year is to wait to see who dies this year. Because they're never going to win. There's no hope. It's a show without hope. And so with The Boys making me feel that way, it just evoked a lot of emotion in me that none of it good. I was like, yeah, okay. So I would have quit if I didn't have to review the show. That's how mad I got. I'm like, I didn't sign up to see this kind of stuff, and they can't just win. So anyway, I know it's violent, I know it's gory, whatever, but, you know, I also know there's some lines. And, you know, so I wasn't happy with that. So let's get into specifics.
Can I make a point on that real quick?
Specific. Sure, go ahead.
I agree with you, and I was shocked by what they had done, but more so than when I heard that the showrunner, Eric Kripke, is petitioning Sony. They say that they filmed numerous pornographic superhero film scenes, and he wants to create a soup porn website and release it through Amazon Studios and Sony Pictures.
Oh, wow.
With these characters.
Yep, not interested. I'm not interested.
And before I had even seen that, I had thought that The Boys is in danger of becoming superhero porn and all the ways, in every possible way that it could be, you know, as far as shock value and shock value of violence, shock value of the plot lines, shock value of the sex. And then I saw this, and then I also saw that in addition to soup porn, they also want to create a G-Men spin-off series that's going to be young adult superheroes in a college that's a combination of Hunger Games and Animal House with R-rated sex and moral boundaries being pushed for young superheroes.
See, that's precisely where the comic book series went, but the show has been giving us something different. So I can't agree with that position to go there when that's not what the show is.
Right.
The show is completely different animals, just... Right. You know, wrapped in familiarity.
Especially when you consider, put it all in the light of the fact that the showrunner specifically wants to create a web domain, a web name called Soup Porn, and release pornographic superhero movies through Sony Pictures and Amazon Prime, and they've already filmed the scenes. They filmed them all for this episode.
Yeah, well, once again, like I said, that's not what I signed up for. And if I didn't have to review it, I would have stopped. I'm like, no. And, you know, I signed up to watch a superhero show, and even though it's edgy and all that,
Right.
Well, come on, you don't review the porn series?
Yeah, no. And you do need to have boundaries. You do need to have some type of definition as to where your show will and will not go. And then also, once again, shifting into writer's code. As a writer, you kind of have to decide what you want to be center stage in your story.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you kind of get into that, you can't really come back from that, because that will be what people remember and talk about and all that. And it's just a whole different type of thing.
See,
and my, remember in the comics when they had Superman do this?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Superman filmed an adult film with, was it Big Barda?
Big Barda.
My problem here is always that thing. It goes back to, define pornography. It's like, well, I'll know it when I see it. And it's like, if you decide that you want to go the whole hog and make porn, then go make porn. You know, that's your thing. But that's not what this is supposed to be, you know?
Yeah.
And the fact that he filmed all those scenes and wants to create the soup porn, it's like, dude, if that's what you want to do, go make superhero porn. I'm sure someone will watch it. But why are you doing that here? And that seems to be also what the guy wants to do.
Tying into our early discussion about, and here's the thing, this is another thing that just enrages me. Here's the thing about when you're going to try to slide your agenda in under the guise of something else.
Right.
Now, because I'm a writer, I strive for originality. I try to create my own things. I try to either create something relatively original or try to put a new spin on an old story.
Mm-hmm.
But it's when you kind of commandeer an established story world, but then you want to use it for your platform. That's what Picard was about. That's what Star Trek Discovery is about. That's what Doctor Who now is about. We see it in so many of our franchises that you want to bash men. You hate men. Okay, well, that's your choice. You're free to hate men if you want to. But you want to commandeer a platform of beloved franchises that have been going on for 40 and 50 years. And you want to use that as a way to promote your agenda. And so that always, both as a writer and as an audience member, pushes me out of something very, very quickly. The first thing the Jodie Whittaker doctor says is like, hey, we're used to the doctor being a man. She's like, oh, well, you got an upgrade. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, yeah, the Ruby Rose Batwoman trailers, which are the worst marketing decisions I think we've seen in a decade. The Batsuit is little perfection. Well, it will be when it fits a woman. Okay. The whole world groaned when she said that. And later on, extended trailer. I don't want a man getting credit for a woman's work. Right. You stole everything that you have from Bruce Wayne. But, that kind of secret. Did you do stuff like that? This boy ain't obvious stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To quote Barack Obama, you didn't build that.
Right. Right. And so that's kind of what I felt here. I was furious. I was like, this is not what I signed up for. This is not what I want. And I know. So if y'all do this, then no, you're going to lose me. I don't care. So, but anyway, getting into specifics. Now, I will say the opening sequence is about as true to life as you want to get. You see someone continually exposed to hateful rhetoric, someone continually exposed to the us and them, that they're the other and we're the good guys, we're the good people, we're the people that deserve life and liberty and happiness. And everybody that's not us deserves a bullet in the brain. So you see this man being exposed to Stormfront's basic ideology and then acting on it, because it creates that paranoia, that fear culture, that however you want to say it or whatever angle you want to look at it on. And it just starts taking people out. That rang so true to me. That was so true to life and that kind of thing. So give me your thoughts about how that scene impacted you when you see somebody get filled with that type of rhetoric that creates paranoia to the point of you're one of them, aren't you? And then now somebody's dead. What do you think about that? Start with Nemesis.
How do I? I thought that it was interesting and clever. I think it hit a little close to home and reality, you know, which is not a bad thing.
Yes.
But how do I put this?
Oh man, stomp on that mind.
I took some exceptions to the very clear side that the writers took when they were writing this scene. Not that I thought that it was badly done, or that I even disagree with everything they were saying, but I think this is their perception of what some current events were, and if I was writing or arguing with these people, I think I could give counter arguments or counter, you know, counterfactual information. So I had to actively put my intellectual disagreement with what they were saying aside so that I could watch the show and not be angry. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I get it. Definitely get it, because it's we talked about it before from multiple angles.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to look at it from gender, if you want to look at it from race / ethnicity, if you want to look at it from age, if you want to look at it from socioeconomic class, no matter what angle you look at it from, what we do in America is we paint these images of people by types.
Right.
So they say, if you don't support certain things, where you're obviously an incel, and that's some type of insult, they're saying that you're so lame, you can't, you know, hook up with anybody, and so your opinion is not valid.
Right.
You're just an angry incel. And that's just, you know, what was that they did on Saturday night? Oh, white male rage with the Joker. White male rage, that kind of thing. So we take these broad strokes and we say, these kind of people are like this. And this is what they do.
Right. And I think I think that was my issue with this opening scene. Not that I wouldn't say that I couldn't sit down with whoever wrote this and have a good discussion with them, because I really do think I could. But I think, and this is, I'm going to get up on Nim's soapbox for a minute and just say that I think a large part of the problem in America 2020 is that we too often say those people, it's exactly what you were just saying, those people are like that. And people are looking right past each other and we're not talking to each other and understanding where the other is coming from. And I saw a lot of that in this scene, in that I think that there was a statement about a certain type of people or a certain movement or whatever it was, and painting them in the way that they wanted to. And I thought they were effective in doing it. I just don't know. I'm a little tired of seeing that kind of stuff everywhere all the time. And I'll just leave it at that, so.
Well, you know, people come in all shapes and colors and sizes and flavors.
Exactly.
And no matter, like you said, no matter where you are on any given issue, it's normally multifaceted. It normally has more than one angle.
Right.
So, like, you know, we could pick any hot button topic, literally.
And
we can say for sure.
And it's not you. I was going to say, it's not unique to this.
There's some responsible gun owners out there.
Right.
There's some people that have firearms that are trained to know how to use them and do everything they can to be safe in their use. And then there are some people who are at the other extreme. And then there's a lot of people all along the spectrum.
Yeah. And it's not unique to this time at all. You know, I remember being a young kid from California before I went in the Army. And, if you had examined my views on what Middle America and the South was like before I went in the Army, and then when I went and I met people from there and I traveled there and learned what it was like there, just night and day, you know, completely different things. And I guess that's the biggest issue I have with this opening scene, is that I think too many people are not taking the time to learn – about all of the great and multifaceted aspects of our country, of our world, of everything. So that's just kind of where I was. But like I said, I put it aside. I had that first reaction to it, then I put it aside, and I watched the show. So.
No, yeah, it's definitely a can of worms. Go ahead, Bracey.
Surprisingly, I didn't have as strong a reaction as Nemesis, being the expressly devout conservative that I am, and understanding where a lot of today's entertainment is heading, or you know, what their agenda is, that sort of thing. But you know, it's just so much these days. It's, you know, we've seen this sort of thing before. I'm working on a little piece about how you have to dehumanize a people or a person in order to do something awful to them. That's the only way that you end up with things like slavery. That's the only way you end up with genocide. You know, you've got to make them less than human. They are now less valuable than you. But this is, we've seen this in comics. You know, in the 70s, we had Claremont, you know, with the X-Men. Eric Larson in the 90s, he did it in one of his issues. This guy got possessed by the Fiend because he was getting a kind of a J. Jonah Jameson broadcast on how terrible the mutant creatures were, and he goes off and he gets possessed by the Fiend, tries to kill a savage dragon. So this played like that for me. And the thing that I appreciate about this team is they didn't make it like, to use the popular terminology these days, some sort of, you know, like alt-right, incel, man, baby, all this stuff. This was a likable guy. He was a likable guy. He seemed like a pretty decent guy. But over time, he just gets bombarded with this stuff. And that's an old propaganda trick. Is, you know, if you keep saying a lie long enough, it becomes the truth. And after a while, this guy just, you know, that's all he hears. It's all he hears. He's all he hears. And we see this happening in culture today, where, like, the media is doing all this, you know, this gloom and doom, all these terrible things. And people get radicalized whether they want to or not, because now they have grown this massive tree of fear in their heart, you know, from all the seeds that have been planted there. And so this normal guy who seems like a pretty decent, everyday kind of guy, he goes out and he kills somebody that he has seen every day for who knows how long. And it's just tragic to me. Tragic scene. But it didn't spark me off the way it did Nemesis.
I think for me, when I watched this scene, there were other things that I bring to it. I will say that I don't want to belabor the point, but I will say that I wish that some writer, maybe I'm the writer to do it, you know, if I ever find myself in a position to do it, I appreciate us trying to realize and integrate, you know, all the different cultures in, and I think that's very important. I think, though, that a lot of times we often warn against the dangers of fear and the dangers of hatred, which are valid things to warn against. One thing that I never see them warn against that I wish they did is the warning against being, how do I put this, too helpful. Does that make sense?
What do you mean by that?
Only if you're a Karen. If you get what I mean by that.
Gosh, I don't want to get too personal, but maybe I will. I'm a Latino, and I grew up in a very poor neighborhood, poor high school, bad neighborhood, and I saw people who were racist and hateful and stuff like that, but I also saw a lot of people that I knew crippled by people who genuinely wanted to help them, but didn't allow them to help themselves. So instead of giving them the opportunity and the tools to succeed on their own, they tried to drag them over the finish line and so crippled them. Does that make, do you understand what I'm saying?
Perfect sense.
Oh, yeah. I got you.
And these are very well-meaning people a lot of the time, or they're people, sometimes they're people that feel guilty about their own internal, I'm not going to say racism, but, you know, feelings about minorities and things like that, and that guilt manifests into them doing, you know, being more helpful that way. But oftentimes you can cripple people that way if you do it too much, and I saw a lot of that growing up. So
yeah, that's really interesting. And again, it always goes back to the loving people together in groups,
mm-hmm.
and not being able to be an individual.
Yes.
And not being able to come to the table and bringing what you bring, and people not even being willing to kind of hear what you have to say. Because I have friends from all walks of life for that very reason, because everybody's got a story and everybody's bringing something different to the table. And I just, you know, love growing as a person by exposing myself to things that were, you know, just things I didn't know, and, you know, people that can take you to a different level.
Absolutely.
Because everybody has their own experience, and everybody's experience is just as real to them as yours is to you. That's what people can't seem to get past. Because what people tend to trumpet is what they've experienced. Nothing wrong. That's not right or wrong or good or bad. It just kind of is what it is.
Right.
But other people's experiences are just as real to them as yours are to you. And that's what people just seem to struggle with. But so anyway, this episode was much more about parents and children, and just about every character is dealing with that on some level. So before we get into that, I do want to talk about someone who is one of the few characters who doesn't seem to be dealing with that issue. She's dealing with something else, and that's Maeve. So I want to tie in season one to this, with Maeve having to deal with, you know, Elena's rejection of her because of finding out what happened on that plane, and then how Maeve responds to that. Because Maeve has really been, like, doing nothing all season long, and now all of a sudden she's here. But here's what I want to throw out. What should Maeve have done with that whole airplane thing? What should she have done? Should she have defied Homelander and try to save the people herself? Can she fly? I don't think she can fly.
Nope. She can't fly.
She can't fly.
Okay, so was she strong enough to lift the plane herself? Should she have told? What should Maeve have done? Because I know Elena's just, she can't get past. I can't believe you let this happen. Okay, as opposed to what? I'm not saying what she did was right, but I want some alternatives. You know how captains on a starship in Star Trek says options. Give me options.
Mm-hmm.
So what could or should Maeve have done? So talk to me about that. Start with Bracy.
Well, being the superhero nerd I am, and having a pretty good grasp of what Maeve's powers seem to be limited to a certain amount of invulnerability and a certain amount of superhuman strength. She doesn't appear to be faster or smarter or more agile than, let's say, like a well-conditioned athlete. So in that situation, she really had no options. She, honest to God, had no options. If she defied Homelander, one of the last things he said to her when he was holding her hand out to her is that, like, don't die with them. Because he was pretty certain that the force of the crash would be enough to kill her as well. Or that she would drown in the wreckage. And so, you know, the only noble thing she could have done would have been to, go down with the ship, as it were. But that would have changed things. Homelander would have spun it into another PR stunt. It would have been even more epic because, you know, another member of the Seven was gone now. And right. They had this whole big, you know, warning thing, and just, you know, wrapped the public around his finger even more. Now, the only way she could make a difference would be to live. But unfortunately, she was too cowardly to say anything about it in public. So she had two moments there to be a hero at a cost, and both times she failed because she was either afraid of death or she was afraid of Homelander.
Right, right. No, that's very well said. Grant, Demetrius, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Jeff hit it right on the head, and I think you asked the right question, which is, it's not what should she have done, it's what could she have done. In this situation, I don't think there's much she could have done at all, short of staying on the plane and just dying, or watching the plane crash and then surviving somehow. I just think it's interesting that Maeve path to that situation is full of a number of choices that she made that we've seen and other choices that we haven't seen that were a number of moments in her life where she could have taken a different direction. She didn't. And it all led to that moment where she really had no choice. And then she ended up losing the person she loved, not really because of that moment, but because all of the previous moments that led up to it.
Yes. I just thought Elena's response was, I understood it, I just thought it wasn't fair, because once again, she didn't step back and say, you know, because Maeve would be dead. If Maeve did anything that, you know, she quote unquote should have done or whatever, she'd be dead. There's just no way around it. Homelander would kill her, or Homelander would kill everyone she loves, which he is threatened to do. Which is why she was trying to hide Elena in the first place. So, I mean, I just thought Elena's reaction was, I didn't like it.
But you see that sort of reaction, you know, in couples are having trouble, like, or even just people who know each other. Sometimes you have an emotional response, and when you're having an emotional response, you don't put the facts together. Or even if you do, you don't really connect it in time. You deny it in time because you're just having a visceral response to things. And that's when people say and do things that they later come back and say, you know, I didn't really mean that.
Yeah, and I also thought that Elena's, you know, I definitely agree that Elena was acting out of emotion. I also think that Elena, if you are Maeve trying to explain the difference in power levels between yourself and Homelander to someone who is a normal human being, you're like, no, of course you're powerful enough to do whatever you want, because you don't understand, you know, living life as Maeve. I really don't think Elena understands. Elena looks at Maeve and is like, you're a superhero, you can lift a car, you can do this, you can do that. Why can't you just stand up to Homelander? Meanwhile, Maeve's going, yeah, I can lift a car and Homelander can burn me right in half. You know, so.
Yeah. Very quickly.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, I've got a rock and he's got a gun.
Right.
Now, that's a good segue into what I'm going to talk about next, which is Homelander and Stormfront and Commandeering the kid. I forgot the kid's name. Rebecca's kid. Is it Ryan? Yes, Ryan. Okay. So Homelander, Stormfront, and Ryan, and how they're trying to basically snatch him from her, and they do. But I have a little different angle. And this is another character I've changed my mind about, which I'm sorry that it happened that way, because I really like her. I still kind of like her. But she's got a little Vanya in her for me now. And that's Becca.
Becca. Yeah, okay.
I really, really liked Becca when she was a myth, when she was a memory, when she was a motivation. The myth, the memory, the motivation of Becca for Butcher. That's when I liked her the most. But now, here's my thought. My thought is, what did you think was going to happen? I cannot accept that this woman at this stage of the game does not understand she's not dealing with people that quote-unquote play fairly or keep their word or act in good faith. She ought to know, I'm not dealing with any of that. I'm dealing with people, both Vaughn and Homelander, that just do what they want to do because might makes right. So I'm still upset that she didn't. Because what she did was reject Butcher and then come to him when she needed him. That kind of stuff makes me mad. That kind of stuff just, I'm like, yeah, okay. He doesn't accept my kid. Oh, you won't be happy. Oh, you're not going to love him. Oh, blah, 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 so I'm not going with you. And then when the people you're dealing with do what we all knew they were going to do, which is take your kid into whatever they want, then now all of a sudden, now you're going, oh, Billy, does that mean I'm so sorry? I need your help. Really? See, my heart kind of changed toward her. Because I'm like, your problem is that none of this is your fault because Homelander forced himself on you. But the situation you're in now is that you don't want to deal with consequences. You think you're going to get out of this consequence free. That somehow you're going to be able to raise your kid, quote unquote, normally and without powers and all the different kind of stuff. And it's never going to happen. that's Homelander's kid. He forced himself on you. That was wrong. That's not your fault. But now we're in this situation. You really think he would ever let you raise Ryan the way you wanted to? Do you think that would ever happen? So I really kind of changed my mind about it. I was like, no, I liked you up to this point, but you just, no. You should have gone with Billy when you had the chance. And that would have been difficult, and it would have been a challenge. But if you know Butcher, you know he would have come around. Might have taken some time. Might not have been as fast as you want. Might not have been everything you wanted. But in his heart, Butcher's actually not a bad guy. He's just hurt. And that's not the same as being evil. So I don't know. Give me your thoughts on that, because my position on Becca has changed a little bit. So give me your thoughts. Start with Nemesis.
I hear what you have to say. I'm going to give you a little bit of a counter-argument for Becca.
Okay.
And here's how that's going to go.
Bring it on.
Before Stormfront was on the scene, Becca had some power over Homelander in that she was the ex-wife with the child with a obviously emotionally deficient man in Homelander. And so she had some female power over him that she could wield, which was ridiculous, but believable, because Homelander didn't know how to you know, he was looking for the mother figure. He definitely had problems when she would get angry, you know, and was trying to avoid confrontation, which seems ridiculous on its face, but there was that dynamic there. You know, she could push him to a certain point, and she knew the limits on that, so she could get some concessions from him. The problem was, is that Daddy got remarried, you know, figuratively speaking, and Stepmom came in, and Stepmom knows all the female tricks in Stormfront, and she could play those as well, not only with Homelander, but also with was it Ryan?
Right.
So she was playing the tricks on him as well, and being the mom figure to him, and doing it pretty damn well. And so suddenly, Becca's only weapon was gone, because there's another woman in the household, and that woman also happens to be a superhero. And so the one card that Becca had to play, she just got played. And she had no weapons left anymore. Which really goes back to what you were saying, is that I don't think she was trying to live a life without consequence. She just wasn't dealing with the reality of the situation. And
that's a life without consequence.
Well, yeah. And she thought she knew all the variables, and she didn't. Because when Stormfront came in, she gave Homelander that female stability that he was looking for, and that female approval that he is looking for, which he didn't need from Becca anymore, so Becca no longer had any power over Homelander at all, and Stormfront completely nullified Becca's power with not only Homelander, but she took a lot of power from Becca when it came to Ryan as well. And eventually, they played the ace they had, which was the fact that Becca had been hiding stuff from Ryan, and that was the straw that broke the camel's back. So Becca thought she was, you know, she thought she had a fairly strong hand, and she only had a pair of twos. So,
well, I think that's a good argument. My only problem with it is, again, Becca's a grown woman. She should have figured out by now they're not going to play fair.
Right.
I think it's ridiculous for her to have any level of expectation, because even if Stormfront hadn't come along, something else would have.
She was playing with fire, definitely. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she had enough experience to know they're not going to do the right thing. You know, she's banging on the door about, you swore we'd be left alone. You wouldn't interfere, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so does a ton of bricks need to fall on your head? But you rejected the one man that loved you enough to risk everything for you. And he would have taken care of the kid for you. You rejected that until these other folks did what they did, and then now you run back to him, now you need him. Now you expect him to take you in. See, that always makes me angry, but that's just me. Go Go ahead, Bryson.
Nah, I like Nosa said, I see Becca's position and thing, but it was a house of cards. And I'm totally on board with UDT. She should recognize that from the time she went banging on boss door. And, you know, like you said, it's like, well, you know, he found you. We can't really do anything to stop him. So,
right.
You know, it is what it is. Like, she should have taken off the first chance she got with Butcher. Because this was always expected. From the moment we found out that we and Homelander found out that Becca was alive and Homelander had a son, we all knew this day was going to come. And she should have, too. So there's no excuse for her. This is a case of denial, thinking she had any sort of power over it. You know, eventually he was going to, like, lose his temper, or maybe his kid's powers would suddenly kick in at the wrong moment, and he lasers through his mom. You don't know. You know, it turns into Brightburn all of a sudden.
Yes.
So, you know, there's that falsity there. It just, she was not living in the real world. And now she's paying for it. And like you said, she turns around and boo-hoos Butcher because she knows he will come. And I'm like you. Like, she's lost a lot of appeal for me because of how this all went down. And the worst thing was, like, I knew it was going to come down like this. And I was still hoping she would do something different, but she didn't.
Yeah, and she had her chance, and it was a better option. Because, you know, there's no way the story ends well anyway. So you might as well try to grab some happiness while you have a chance.
I guess that's what she was trying to do in her little house in the prairie there. But even then, you know, I'm trying to give him a mother, but your kid's still not socialized. He's still going to be Homelander light. When he starts to experience things, and that's exactly what happened.
See, and this,
when he took him up, it's like, hey, you've been living on this compound. There's a whole big world out there. It's like, you're right. I hate you, Mom.
And we could tie all this back to Umbrella Academy and the choice Allison made in not poisoning her relationship with Ray. Because we see here that the little lie keeps building, and eventually it bites you in the ass. So,
precisely.
It was just really something. But also remember, you're dealing with a kid that has death in his eyes.
Yeah.
So when he loses control, people are going to die. There's no way around that, and that's the reality.
How many times as a child did you get spanked? And like, just because you're upset, like, man, I wish you would die. Well, you know, when you got somebody with superpowers, that happens in an instant.
Right, you got Homelander's kid with killer heat vision. It's not just regular heat vision, because Superman's heat vision tends to burn. This is killer vision, because this only takes a few seconds and you are over.
It's totally laser eyes. It cuts through.
That's right. So that's what you're dealing with.
That's why Lois Lane buys kryptonite diapers. So.
right. You better get Titano, the gorilla with kryptonite vision. Anyway. That leads me to this next thing. I've said this before, but it bears repeating here because of what happens in the episode. And that is that when they don't like the character they're lampooning, they really don't like the character they're lampooning. So when they created the Deep, the Deep is every worst cliche, stereotype, nightmare, criticism of Aquaman that has ever existed. Literally. So if you can think of everything you might hate about Aquaman, that's who the Deep is to the extreme.
Or men in general.
That's a whole other pod. So, but I have discovered, I've said this before, that it seems clear to me they feel the same way about Green Lantern. Because Lamplighter is such a miserable character. He's a miserable person, he's a miserable character, and nobody on any team that he's on really respects him. Like, the Seven didn't really respect him, and Billy, and what's her name? He fried her grandkids. She didn't really respect him. They all laughed at him. And so he's one of those, he almost has little man syndrome. Like, I'm trying so hard to look cool, one of the Seven, whatever, but people are really kind of laughing at me of our powers. And the reason I say all that is to highlight what happens in this episode. And basically, he takes himself out in literally the stupidest way possible. Because wouldn't a flame metahuman be invulnerable to flame? How could you burn yourself up when controlling fire is your power? Wouldn't you be flame resistant?
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have seen this in comics. For instance, Roberto DaCosta originally had superhuman strength, but he didn't have the durability that came with it. It came from the energetic power of the soul absorption of his cells, allowing him to physically move great masses. So there are people who can control flame in the comics, but they can still get burned by the flame. You notice he never generates the flame. He's always acting on existing flame.
Yeah, like
and that's the difference between him and a human torch.
The mutant.
I was going to say he's not the human torch, right? I get it.
The mutant pyro. Yeah. I think like the mutant pyro.
It's kind of lame because he's been eaten alive with guilt all this time, and he's still burning people to death in the Sage Grove facility. And there's nothing. Here's my point. There's nothing redeemable about this character. And a part of me feels like that's the way they feel about the Green Lanterns, because that's who he's, you know, a spoof of. And just like the Deep, they really hate Lamplight May. He has literally not one redeeming quality.
Well, I guess because Green Lanterns are super cops and you want to defend the police, so.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
So he ends up taking himself out because he can't live with it anymore. He can't live with the tally of bodies he's had, you know, all the different kind of stuff. So instead of other ways to handle that, some characters are written to where when they have that moment, they dedicate the rest of their time to trying to do some good with the life they have left. That may or may not make up for what you've done in the past, but it's one option. Like that was actually the story of Xena.
Mm-hmm.
Xena was just a terror, really. And then she had an epiphany. She realized that she didn't want to be that way anymore. But so she tried to spend her time after that not fighting for what she used to fight for, not being a thief and a vagabond and a tyrant and a genocidal person. But she tried to fight for people that couldn't fight for themselves. So she tried to do something with her time. So they could have written him that way, but he's like, no, can't live with myself. So I'm going to go out in a quote-unquote blaze of glory, but it was really kind of a cop-out to me. But it's just because they hate this character. So I want to hear your thoughts on that. Just, you know, what do you think about my comparison to the Green Lanterns? What do you think about Lamplighter in general? And definitely I want to hear about how he goes out. Start with Bracey.
You know, he strikes me as like I've had some people in my life who've had some very intense problems, which led them to downward spirals that they never seemed to shake off. And you would think that at a point that you would get so far, and you know, some people do bounce back and others don't. Especially if you feel your offense is bad enough, if you are worthless, if you are irredeemable, it's easy to keep going down that road. What does he do? He burns people alive for the government as an orderly, because that just continues to verify that he's a worthless, monstrous thing. Then he, you know, he doesn't deserve any redemption, any happiness. He fulfills his own prophecy by continuing to be a monster, even though he's just a toady in a lab now. The commentary on the Green Lantern, I don't know if it's so much the writers having a commentary on the Green Lantern, or if it's related to what they did in the comics. I don't remember Lamplighter playing that big a part in the comics. It's been a while since I read them. And, you know, his stint in the show is so brief. It's not like The Deep, where we can see they are really just hating on that guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I was unsurprised that he would take himself out, and especially take himself out in that way, because he felt like he deserved to feel what those kids felt. And he had not moments of redemption, but he did have at least moments of awareness that he knew this is what he deserved. You know, he wanted to be shot. He was telling it like it was to Huey in the apartment. You know, he's like, yeah, I got you in here, but I really wanted to make this last stupid, futile statement by immolating myself in front of my own statue. So in the end, I'm not even that good a guy to do something good in the end. I'm still just on one last ego trip. Sad character who won't really be missed.
Yeah, moments of redemption, moments of awareness. I really like that. Sad character won't be missed. I really like that. Agree. Go ahead, Nemesis.
Yeah, Lamplighter, I hate to say it, but he kind of like just, he's a sad sack. He's a person that's easily used, you know? He was used by everybody around him, and he knew it, and he didn't like himself very much, you know? And he's just a commentary on, I don't know, commentary on whatever. I have a hard time seeing Green Lantern in him, even though I know that that's what they were going for. His power set reminds me a lot more of like a Pyro from the X-Men. And his character, I'm not sure that I've ever seen a character like that in comics before, but I mean, he was kind of worthless all the way around, and he knew it. I mean, that's how he viewed himself, as worthless. And so his end, he was also a person that saw everything in the starkest terms, as far as he saw things as being, he was incredibly negative, you know? And so when he killed himself that way, I thought it was telling that one of his last lines was the fact that he was upset that his statue, they had taken away his statue in the Seven, which pretty much says all you need to know about his character, and that all of his self-worth was built into his image as a hero in the Seven, and that was kind of the last straw for him. So when even that was gone, I'm pretty sure that he intended on killing himself anyway, but when he saw that even that legacy was gone, what little bit of shred of respect he had for himself was completely shattered, and that was the end for Lamplighter. It's really quite a depressing character, to be perfectly honest with you.
Yeah, I agree with that too.
Think about how it mirrored that scene with the Deep too, that little throwaway scene they had where he was like standing in front of like this cutout of the Seven. He's like, they cut me out.
That's right. But you were never really him.
Yeah. Disposable.
Not like you wanted to be. Okay, next thing I want to talk about is this whole fight with Black Noir, Annie, and Maeve. I have to say, I really thought Annie was going to die.
Yeah.
I don't put anything past this show anymore. So I really thought we were going to lose her. I was like, man, do they really have the courage to take out Starlight? Because that would be such a shocking moment. It would be all anybody talked about from this season, because she's basically been our point of view character. Her and Huey, we've been following them from the beginning in terms of experiencing this world. And I'm like, would they really take her out? Because I thought for sure Annie was gone. I was like, oh, well, no more Starlight. But then we get a save from Maeve, which was kind of cool, except the Alma Joy thing. Going for laughs or peanut allergy, you're trying to save this dude who's basically metahuman Batman. If Batman had Superman's powers, he'd be Black Noir. That's who we were dealing with. And all you have to do is stuff like an Alma Joy in his mouth, and he's... Really? That's the kryptonite? Really? So I don't know. I don't know if that was supposed to be funny. I didn't quite know. I didn't get it. Because I was like, it felt like the resolution of the scene was disproportionate to the buildup. It felt like they really created a serious moment of tension where we had to ask ourselves, is Starlight going to make it or not? And then the resolution is, yeah, because of Alma Joy, so... Because, you know, part of the running joke has been how Annie likes nasty candy bars. And that's kind of been a thing with her for the last several episodes, and it's a nasty candy bar that saves her. So maybe that's what they were going for in a kind of weed nest kind of way. That's kind of a Joss Whedon thing to do. So I don't know. I want to hear what you thought about it, though, because, like I said, the fight was brutal. And we know what Black Noir is capable of, and he'll do it all in silence, and he's just an incredible character and incredibly scary. And I was glad to see Maeve being heroic again. Mm-hmm. But it's like she's another one who won't go all the way with it. So anyway, but let me hear your thoughts about that fight. Start with Nemesis.
I definitely like the beginning with the fight with Black Noir and Starlight. And like you, I was like, Starlight's in some serious trouble here. I will say this. I've read some of The Boys, and it seems to me that Black Noir has been nerfed in this series. He should be even stronger, yes. And that Maeve shouldn't even be able to keep up with him from what I remember. Am I wrong in that, Jeff? Because you know The Boys.
No, you're right. I think a lot of them have been nerfed.
Yeah.
I mean, Black... one of them tried to catch the airplane, and you know they just applied some real-world physics, which is why it didn't work in the comic book.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're not DC level, but they're up there.
Yeah, Black Noir is... I don't want to spoil anything. This is sloppy spoilers, but if I remember correctly, Black Noir is like on top tier. So, which makes him even scarier. And then the stuff with the Almond Joy, I was just like, come on now. You know, I was like, this is just, you didn't know how to end the fight, so you decided you wanted to be clever, and it came off as hokey, you know? Because you're like, oh, look, this incredibly powerful character has this weird kryptonite to him. But it's like, come on, you know, write something better than that. That's the way I felt about it. When I was watching this, I actually laughed out loud watching it. And it was a little bit humor for me, you know, humorous. And a lot of it was like, oh, come on now. You know, this is ridiculous. Because I was like, find some other way to write yourself out of this. And then, of course, this is puts him into the coma, but, you know, which explains this weird decision by Maeve to hang around, which, once again, I don't understand these people that, like, betray their teammates or betray whoever and then decide to hang around the very place where they're in danger now. But, okay, that's just me, so.
I think hokey is the perfect word. Perfect word for that. It was just a hokey ending. I was like, okay, you're bordering on Wile E. Coyote physics with that one.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Bracey. What do you think?
Yeah, Black Noir is such a cool character, especially in this villainous kind of set. You know, as soon as he was on the scene, you're like, oh, Starlight, you better just, like, fry everything you can see right away and run for it, because you don't have a prayer. You know, this is not A-Train you're dealing with. This guy is a killer. That's all he's about. And so the fight went exactly as I expected. Now, I was like you. I was like, are they really going to kill him? I mean, have they got the balls to do it? And then when Maeve stepped in, I thought, like, oh, she's going to have to kill Black Noir. Are they going to have to kill him together? Or he's going to kill one of them, and the other one's able to take him out. I thought for sure somebody was going down because, you know, you get Black Noir on the scene, and people just die. That's all there is to it.
Mm-hmm.
I will say on reflection, because I wasn't thinking about the candy bar gag, the running gag they had with Starlight and the candy bars, I think that's kind of cute. Maybe not clever, but I think it's kind of cute. I thought that was like a little subtle thing, and we've talked before about how a lot of current writers have been influenced by Joss Whedon, and that definitely feels like a Whedonism right there. But honestly, I thought if they were going to defeat Noir, that Maeve was going to have to, like, just literally beat him almost to death, or, you know, Starlight fry a hole in him or something, and that he would probably wouldn't die, but he'd end up in, like, some sort of, like, a coma as his body healed up. You know, we get the situation with, like, what was the mental guy from Stargirl? Psychic guy. Yeah, we get a situation like that where he's out of the picture for a while, because, you know, that guy's too good to, like, waste on an easy death. But I will say this about the cheesy way they took him out. This is not necessarily the first time the show has broken its own rules about how superpowers work in this world. I can believe that he did have a peanut allergy, even with all of the superhuman attributes, because apparently so far only Stormfront and presumably Homelander and maybe now Ryan, because he's natural born, are the only perfect superheroes. They've got, like, the perfect physiology and all that, and we've seen how much more durable, for instance, Stormfront is. I mean, like, she can take Homelander's full-on heat blast without getting sliced in two. So everybody else is a little bit less, and so, like, you know, I agree with his physical stats. It doesn't seem like he should have a food allergy, but here's, like, an example of them defeating their own logic. In the episode where they had the invisible dude captured, and they decided, like, oh, you know, he's not invulnerable from the inside, so they stick some C4 up his butt. But when Huey sets it off, you should have just maybe heard a muffled explosion, but they wanted the sight, they wanted the shocking sight gag of blowing him up. But his skin is invulnerable. It should have contained the explosion. Even if his insides get obliterated, maybe there's like a gout of blood that spills out, you know, from his invisible butt onto the floor. But there wouldn't have been pieces of him everywhere. So sometimes the show does break its own logic.
Thank you for that visual.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's what I do.
Got that in my head now.
Talk about explosive diarrhea.
As my wife is making dinner, I got that right in my brain.
Okay, speaking of explosive, we're going to wrap this one up with, of course, the scene we have to talk about, the final scene where they finally... Now, there's a side story there about Billy coming to face his father, and his father's just like... You know, remember, they hate dads in literature now, so his father's just another example of the worst kind of dad, which is always, you know, taking out his anger on you, beating the crap out of you, never has anything good to say, and then when you get grown, he tells you it was your fault, but you'd been a better kid. So, yeah, no, so whatever. So there's that whole side story. That did not make Butcher more interesting to me or not. He's fine the way he is. But the final scene we have to talk about, obviously, is where they finally get Joe to testify, and I thought they got him. They finally got him. They got the mad scientist that was behind all this madness. The dude that basically raised Homelander, the man whose science made all this possible. And they've convinced him under threat of death. You know, Grace said, do the right thing. Billy's like, you don't do the right thing, I'm going to kill anybody you love, which is your kid. So one way or the other, they got him there. And I'm like, finally they got him. And what happened? Holy cow, those heads start popping like balloons with a clown at a kid's party. I was like, wait a minute. And when you see that happen, you're just like, holy cow, really? And so, I mean, and so many heads are popping. And you're just like, oh, my goodness. And it's just another mess. And it is definitely the boys' version of a Red Wedding, if you will.
Yeah.
And it was just like, holy cow. They're not going to be able to get through this. Once again, it's not going to be a clean win. Whatever happens after this, it's going to be even messier because they just lost their star witness. So it was a spectacular moment. It was a moment that had a lot of emotional weight. Everything Huey and Annie and Butcher had been working up to that point, and they were looking with pride, and they're like, we got you, Bob. We got you, we got you. Pop! I'm like, oh no, we don't. So I didn't really have mixed emotions. I thought it was really powerful. I thought it was really well done. It was just the only thing I felt was like, you know, once again, not going to be a clean or an easy win. They can't just win. It's got to be some type of tragedy involved. But anyway, so give me your thoughts on that whole scene, like what you were thinking when you first saw it. Because I actually had to watch it like 3 times. I watched it and I rewound, I watched it again. I'm like, holy cow, this really happened. Because I was hoping it was going to be like a dream sequence or something. I'm like, oh no, okay, this actually happened in real time. This is canon in the show. And Stormfront is just like, la la la, next. She's so casual. Homelander's like, la la la, oh well, I guess that happened. Alrighty, I guess we're out of here. I'm like, oh my goodness, you two are just idiots. But anyway, give me your thoughts, start with Nemesis.
The scene itself in the actual hearing, I thought was incredible. And it shocked me. I did not see it coming. I watched it several times as well. I was confused by where, because the only person I've seen with this power, I didn't see her anywhere. So I was like, Where in the world is this coming from? And I've already seen this happen to someone else, which was the CIA person that one time. So I was like, what is going on here? This isn't a criticism. This is a writing choice, a writing code thing was for me, if I put myself in the place of the boys, You know, so the guys watching on TV, so Huey and Mother's Milk and all them, I think that I would have been much more vocal. This is, you know, this show loves to drop F-bombs. I would figure somebody would have dropped, like, get the blank out of here, you know, and, like, punch a wall, and somebody else is just laughing hysterically because it's so ridiculous that, you know, they've done all this work, and now, you know, life has thrown a 2020 at them again, and, you know, all this stuff going on. So I would have had, like, different reactions from those guys, like, you know, one person is just sitting there staring at it, just can't believe what they're seeing, you know, so that would be the only, that's how I would have written that, you know. Huey would probably be just staring there in disbelief. Butcher would probably be the one like, mother effing C words, you know, I don't want to say that, I don't like saying that word, so, you know, and saying something. Mother's Milk would be just like that. Frenchie would probably be laughing, you know, so that is a writer's choice, you know. I understand they did have some reaction to it, but overall, yeah, I very much liked the ending, and it took me completely by surprise.
Yeah, it was really something. Go ahead, Brayton.
You know, I'm like, I kept thinking, well, this can't go down. Something's got to happen. Somebody's going to have to take out the scientists here. But, you know, it'd been long enough in between the CIA ladies had gone plop in this scene that you know, had enough time to kind of sort of forget about that a little bit. And so when the first head goes, like, oh, this thing is happening again, but, like, I didn't expect it to be the literal bloodbath that it became.
Yeah.
I thought Homelander and Stormfront's reactions were just appropriate. They're just casually looking around trying to identify the source of the problem before they deal with it. If I was them, I'd be worried, like, well, maybe this can affect me, too. Maybe we should fly out the window, you know.
I was
too casual, even though you're like super tough. You know, these are heads blowing up. You don't know if this can affect you or not. That's taking a lot for granted, even knowing that they're like laser proof.
I was waiting for Samuel L. Jackson, the end of Kingsman, to pop in, you know. So
at least it was a rainbow explosion.
Yeah.
But this actually left me, this scene left me the same questions and more so than I had the first time we saw this. All right, we're all wondering, who is out there with this power? One of my guesses is Edgington. I've talked with some of my friends about this. That's the only way I could see him having any sort of control over somebody like Homelander and now Stormfront. If he's that casual in the face of such power, it can't just be... he's too smart for it just to be the thing like, oh, you know, I've got physical power over him, or, you know, some other sort of power. You know, if this guy snaps, he's going to cut you and the entire building in two with his eyes. Mm-hmm. So it can't be that. He's got to have some way of defending himself. If he's got some sort of genetic kill switch they can activate, something he can do really fast. That's my thought. So I like to think it's Edgington. I'll have to watch it again to see if he is actually present at the trial. The second thing is, in both cases, not the initial threat, but the peripheral threat is dealt with. The scientist is dealt with. The CIA agent is dealt with. I get the feeling this person, all the powers that we've seen so far, have to have line of sight. We haven't seen anybody who can, like, basically remote view their target and do something to them. So going by the established logic, it has to be line of sight, whether it's on a monitor or, you know, actual visual contact.
And that's why watching this, I was so confused, because I was looking for that woman from the asylum, but she wasn't out when the CIA...
She wasn't there. So right. I don't think it's her.
Right.
But here's my thing, though. If this person recognizes the boys are a threat, they were talking to the CIA lady, why didn't they all get their heads exploded right then? And here we are in the courtroom. Why didn't they take out the boys once again? What's the point of leaving them alive?
Right.
There's got to be a point to it. So I'm curious to see what it's going to be, because they're already scapegoat. How much more scapegoat do they need to be?
Right.
Well, the question is always, what is their end game? Like you said, where are they going with it?
Mm-hmm.
And why would they leave any witnesses, and why would they leave a possibility for themselves to be caught that whole thing? So, yeah.
And I know we're running...
Stormfront took out an entire building to make sure nobody can blame her.
Yeah. Right? And I know we're running out of time, but the other question I keep asking myself is, where is this whole Church of the Collective thing going? So.
Well, I don't know. It seemed to be a bit of a detour, but it doesn't seem to be central to the basic. Remember, I said at the beginning of this year, they threw away the best thing they had going, was that nobody knew about Compound V.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they were trying to sell them as heroes, and we got to see the dark underside of the Seven was this glorious thing, and now we got to see the underbelly. They've gone away from that and just showed us underbelly. And what made it more interesting was it being juxtaposed against the idea of them being these grand heroes that everybody just worships and loves. But now, Stormfront, I keep wanting to call it Stormlander. Have you noticed that? Yes. Stormfront is a hate monger, and now she's a known hate monger. And Homelander has had visions of lasering people because they disagreed with him, but they did see the video of the collateral damage of him killing that civilian. And so the juxtaposition of their image versus the reality is what made the show interesting. And they threw a lot of that away.
Right.
So now it feels like with the Church of the Collective, there's an opportunity there to not just make fun of Scientology, which is what they're doing, but maybe to use it as image rehab, not just for the deep, but in general for the show and the characters. That's the only thing that I can see making it redeemable. That because remember, it was everything to them in the first season.
Yeah.
Their image was everything. And now it's like, they don't care. And I'm like, yeah, well.
It's just that. Kind
of undermining the entire purpose of the show.
The Church of the Collective seems to have taken up an awful lot of air. You know, taken a lot of the oxygen out of the room during the season. And I haven't seen a real payoff yet. So I'm curious where it's going.
Well, it's the same thing with all the stuff they've done with the Deep in general.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's really going nowhere unless they pull off something really crazy with the whole Church of the Collective. It better be a good payoff after having to suffer through all of these scenes.
Yep.
Well, they don't know what to do with the Deep other than make him the butt of every joke. But now they don't know what to do with A-Train now that they've basically made him, given him a severe handicap, and that he's overdosed on Compound B, and he's, you know, at risk of a heart attack all the time. That's cool, but if you're going to have the Flash, he's going to have a heart attack every time he runs. Then you kind of wrote yourself in a corner with that. What can you do with that? You either have to take the heart attack portion away, you know, and, you know, so they've kind of written themselves in a couple of corners using our writer's code hat. And so you got to have a story reason to justify all this screen time. Got to be some type of payoff to where it feeds into the main story. Otherwise, it's just filler inside of the episode. And that's never interesting. You know?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to call it there. Had a good time discussing this episode, as always. It involved a lot of very strong emotions for a lot of very strong reasons. And, you know, once again, to throw on writer's code to all the writers that might be listening, you know, you are free to draw your lines in your story worlds wherever you want to. But one, you need to draw some clear lines. And number two, you need to let your audience know. Otherwise, people are going to feel like they've been bait and switched.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever kind of presentation you want to make, whatever kind of tone you want to set, at least let people know up front. Because if it changes in the middle, then you just make a lot of people angry and you lose a lot of your base. So just kind of a writer's code tip. Because you, in your story world, if you're the writer, you can create whatever you want, but you definitely need to let your audience know this is what you're in for, so people can make a choice as to whether or not they want to consume your content enough or not. But when you come out of nowhere with something that's just way over the top, then no, you're going to lose people and you're going to really offend them. So, just throwing that out there. So anyway, I want to thank my co-hosts for another great pod. Thank you so much, Nemesis.
No worries. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bracey.
Hey, man, it is good to be back.
Thank you so much to our listening audience, and we miss Steve tonight. Steve has some other things to do. Steve's no longer with us. Shout out to him. Miss him. Miss his voice on the pod. So thank you so much for listening. Check out the other pods we have on the network. And we will see you next time on the next episode of Sloppy Spoilers. Spoilers. Spoilers.